Today's guest is a comedian, writer, and an actor. This multi-talented guest has been a Bob Curry Fellow, a Tim Sims finalist, and an alumnus of Toronto's Second City Touring Company. He's also a friend of the festival. His film, Plants Out of the Sunlight, screened at the 2011 Real Asian, and he's been a recurring star in a number of our festival gems, such as Sweet Sweet Chinatown, which you heard as part of today's opening. Today, he joins us to talk about the latest season of Tall Boys. Frank, sorry, wow.
Frank,
this is my Chinatown.
Today's episode includes spoilers to the second season of Tall Boys. If you haven't had a chance to watch the show, and you don't want to be spoiled, come back after you've had a chance to watch it on CBC Gem.
This is my Chinatown. I'm Vietnamese.
Hey, it's me, Frank.
What's up, Frank?
Yes. You know, I do some acting, you know. I box. I do some characters. Yeah, it's me, Frank.
Hey, Franco.
Hey, what's up?
Thanks for coming on Backstory. We're really excited to hear. You know, we were really excited to hear that Tall Boys had a second season. You know, we were following it when you all were on set. You had posted a whole bunch of videos. They were really funny. So we're really excited to talk to you in advance. You know, we're talking to you. I think it's coming out tomorrow. This episode's going to come out in a week or so. But it's really funny, and it's really continued to deliver the kind of character and humor that that you guys bring to the table. But before we get into the show, I wanted to know, what did you do on Valentine's Day that you had to make us push the recording date?
Dude, I'm this is hard-hitting questions.
What do, I don't even remember. What we do.
Was it 8:30? I think it was Valentine's Day. We had like a nice little dinner, put the baby to sleep, hung out, had some dinner, had some chocolates, made eye contact. We took some edibles. My friend made us this like THC rum. I think it's called tincture or something like that. And a lot of the time we were just waiting for it to go to kick in. So I was like, oh, do you feel it? I don't think. And then like every like 20 minutes into it, I'm like, I think I feel it. And I stood up. I'm like, no, I don't feel it. And then we just went to sleep.
I'm sure you got a good rest then.
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was it was Valentine's Day. So I was like, oh, I should probably not be working.
It's a good idea. So I'm glad you had a nice evening. You know, what were some things that you were looking to do creatively with season two? There's always the kind of growth of an artist and you guys as a group. And then the growth of the show. What were some things that you were looking as a team to do creatively with this season?
It was more of being confident in our process more than like looking to tackle particular subject matter or trying to create a particular type of scene. It was more about finding the confidence to speak up and being able to double down and really take a risk with 100% confidence. Because in season one, everything was a dream come true and it felt so surreal. And so there were a lot of moments where I think we were all kind of like deep down afraid that if we didn't like something or if we just critiqued something, it would just be perceived in a negative way. And also we felt like, you know, I all had an incredible sense of imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. So season two was a lot about like just really trying to fight and being more confident with our choices and more deliberate. Like I remember one time the costume person, Nicole Manick. She's like so fantastic and she's incredibly kind and so great. But I had never worked with someone like this before. And I remember she gave me like a pink shirt. I remember like walking up and down the hallways being like, I want to do white, but should I ask her for a white shirt? Oh man, what if she yells at me? And literally like 20 minutes of just being like, okay, I'm going to be that guy. Okay. Everyone's going to hate me, but I'm going to do it. And then as I walked up to Nicole, I was like, hey, do you think we could try this in white? And then she's like, yeah, let's do that. And then we changed shirts. And then when I looked in the mirror, I'm like, pink looks better. That certainly is something I noticed. For myself, I don't know if a lot of people from my particular background, Vietnamese, Asian, low income, have this feeling, but I'm always afraid to go first. I'm like that. It's that whole thing of like, I don't want to eat the last piece of food. I don't want to ask for anything. If someone offers, like I always go to a friend's house and they'd be like, hey, do you want anything to drink? I'm like, no. And then like right after I'm like, my body's like, but you're thirsty though.
I'm so thirsty.
And I'm like, why did I say no? But, and I just remember even in like our pitch meetings, and this is, you know, amongst our friends, like I was always like nervous to, you know, be the first to pitch an idea. With season two, we felt way more safer because we already did one season. We got to know our directors and our executive producers a lot better. And after season one, they're like, you know, by the end of the last few weeks of shooting in season one, we got so comfortable with the crew and we realized everyone's there just to make the best show they could. So so season two was a lot more about just trying to push and just, for me, I was just trying to avoid any moment where I felt like, oh, should I speak up? Just like really trying to speak up and say something.
When we were talking about the show, there's a lot of challenges from, there's COVID challenges, 2020, like, you know, reckoning with racial injustices, and then also trying to produce comedy within that. And, you know, in the past, you have told me that there's this like challenge and burden, or this, not necessarily your words, but of producing kind of quote unquote more conscious comedy. And so you're writing amidst all of that. And, you know, just wondering, how can you be responsive to that? Maybe you can talk about the writing process in 2020 as you were writing for this.
I think a lot of the times we wrestle with a lot of like, you know, what is the sketch saying? Is it being conveyed? And what are we trying to say with it? But every sketch starts with, it comes from a place of joy. And we're like, oh, this is really funny. And then as we get into the second and third draft of the sketch, we're like, is this even funny? Our ideas of what is funny can change from day to day. Like I always say, I use like Pluto is the planet that's not a planet anymore, right? Like, because a lot of the times we get into these conversations about like, our audience is too sensitive today. Oh, PC culture this, which is kind of weird because like comedy is like, the great thing is like there are new audiences that are finding comedy that speaks to them. And that kind of, you know, PC culture, freedom, we can't say whatever we want type of comedy. It's really popular. And there's so many comedians that get specials with that type of attitude. And with us, we are aware that we are four BIPOC individuals, and that when we got the show initially, people would see us in a way where it was like, oh, is this an affirmative action type of group, or whatever racial bias they'll apply when they hear of a show like Tall Boys and then they see us with our particular makeup. So season one, like before we premiered, there was a lot of like, oh, well, how will people perceive us? But then with season two, we felt like we should just go back to what makes us comfortable and what makes us laugh. Yeah. So going back to the thing I was saying about the planets, the way you do comedy changes from audience to audience. And so if I did a joke about, Pluto, in front of a NASA audience, I'd probably bomb. But if I did it in front of like an astrology audience, they'd be like, oh my gosh, you know my sign. And so like, and then once like Pluto, we found out like Pluto wasn't a planet, all my jokes about Pluto where it was a planet probably wouldn't work anymore. And then now it's like, okay, I'm hearing that Pluto is like a dwarf planet. So then someone in the audience is going to be like, actually it's both. So I guess like, I think a lot of older comedians feel like they can't say what they want to say, but the reality is what they were saying before was not truthful for a lot of people's experiences. And so for us, we want to do comedy that's truthful to our experience, but sometimes our experience is very limited, and then we might hear something from somebody and then we're like, okay, we have to re-examine this particular sketch and see how it reads to us, it reads to them and reads to us.
How many of the sketches in season two are things that were existing already, like even going back to your live repertoire? And then did you find it challenging to write for it without having live shows to also perform and kind of like test things out? And I don't know if that's part of your writing process when you're writing for a show, but I believe some of your season one sketches were things that were part of your live show. So was that something that you encountered at all?
Season one was, I think like a lot of the first episode and maybe a little bit of the second episode had a bunch of like sketches that were adapted from our live show. And then the rest of the season, we had to learn how to write for TV. Mm. And so that was kind of challenging because we used to just sit in a room for like 4 hours and just try different stuff out, and then we'd bring it on stage. And we all were stand-up comedians too, like we did improv and sketch comedy, but we did a lot of our sketches in stand-up open mics. So a lot of times when you do like a stand-up open mic, it's just a bunch of other stand-ups waiting for their turn and not really paying attention. And then when we would go on, people would be like, oh, this is acting weird. And I feel like that made us more excited because it felt like harder to get a laugh in that type of environment. In season two, we didn't really do any live stuff because we, you know, aside from the first episode and a half, everything else was written in the room. And so season two was like, yeah, just the continuation of that, like learning how to be more efficient, to write faster, write for TV, and learning what would make it in the cut. Just learning how to be more economical with your writing. Yeah, so that was in season two.
I'm just curious too, in writing for TV, you know, in TV it's this like broad audience that you never see. And so how do you approach that type of writing?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't really think about the audience and the wide range in the...
That's an approach.
Yeah, I mean, generally, I think we just kind of write what makes the room laugh. Oh, wait. Oh, it's been... See, the thing is, the COVID has been so long that I forgot that we did a bunch of live read-throughs of our sketches of season one. And we read a bunch of them to see how... just to get a sense of, yeah, a little bit of live audience feedback. And yeah, so that was one of the things we did where we're like, okay, let's see where, if these things are working, what the rhythm feels like, where the laugh points are, where the dead spots are, and where we need to punch up. But then like COVID hit, and then we had to like rewrite a bunch of things, and like we had to cut a bunch of stuff because I'm like, you know, some of the sketches had like four people sitting next to each other. I'm like, this is dangerous now. So yeah, and then like, yeah, after we were actually supposed to go to camera like the first week of April, we went on our break around like March 9th, and we're supposed to come back the next week to get into rehearsal to go to shoot camera 2 weeks after. But right when we went on our break, like the NBA shut down, and then we just had to rewrite everything from there.
So you shut down during COVID, and so when did you pick up again?
We were originally supposed to shoot from April to, it's like 2 months, right? April to June. But then we ended up shooting mid to late September to early November. Other thing about writing is when you do it live, you're kind of editing it on the spot because you can always improvise stuff and you can always adjust your performance as you get feedback from the audience. I guess in the television medium, you do get a feel for it in the editing room too. So season one, I was like really on book. I was like kind of scared to go off book because I was like, oh, I want to make sure continuity is good. But then when we went to the editing room in season one, a lot of things like made the sketch better, where it was like the punchline we wrote for this scene kind of works. But then they would put in like an improvised line right at the end and it just makes the scene way better. So if you see the Tolerate sketch, that part where the white woman reaches for the drink and glucose, not for you. That wasn't in the script. But then when we watched it, that they added that joke in the middle and we're like, oh, we should put that part at the end and it would just like close out the sketch and make it feel like complete.
We saw that you had worked with Shad on some songs in this season. Is that what happened? How did that come about?
Oh man, that was crazy. I forgot how it came about. I don't remember how it came about, but he worked on season one too. Him and his producer, King Tao. I don't know. It was great. I don't remember how Shad came about. I think maybe Bruce contacted him, Bruce McCulloch. And he came to one of our live read-throughs before season one premiered, like before we went to camera, and he was really down and he liked our stuff. And then I guess, yeah, he was so cool. Yeah, he was really nice guy. It was really cool to work with. Yeah, it was so weird because in season one, there's a scene where Gulat has a rap beef and he does a really bad rap. Uh-huh. It was just so weird to watch Gulat rap this super cheesy, corny rap. And then like Shad is like bobbing his head, just listening to the recording in the booth. And there's like a mixer there and we're in this like weird, like fancy studio. And it's just like, what is this world?
Well, it's awesome that you were brought together with him. And, you know, like the musical numbers are always so much fun and it, you know, brings out a lot. And, you know, I'm sure it gives you all like a different chance to flex a different type of performance, you know? I mean, if anything, it's probably just really fun to do those, right? Like the renting out your basement that you were the headliner of.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That was the other, like, I was so nervous about that.
Oh, really?
I think, why? Like, well, in season one, like, so you asked the question, like, the other thing about season one, as a writer, I have a lot of trouble writing for myself, and it's much easier for me to write for others. The Gulat gets into a rap beef, like, that's so funny to me. And if it comes out on paper and I see it, or like if I write a scene with Vance in it, I'm like, oh yeah, this is so funny to me. But if I put myself in it, I kind of feel like insecure, or like, I'm like, oh, I don't know if people will want to see this. So it was kind of like,
who does this guy think he is? He's writing stuff for himself. That kind
yeah,
of
yeah, but it comes from me. So, yeah. So it was like difficult to just like get over my own self-critical voice. I feel like I'm really hard on myself in that way.
So were you nervous about that one because you wrote that one and you were going to be the one to perform it?
Yeah, I think I was nervous. I mean, I had this feeling last season too, but I always have, like, I'm very like nervous and extra self-conscious when I am the anchor of a scene. Which in season two, I was like, I felt way better about. Because I felt looser, especially there's certain sketches where I just really got out of my shell. I think there was just a point where that felt like such a huge risk for me, like being an anchor of a sketch, like being the focal point and not just like a side character that says like one line.
Mm-hmm. What is that about? I mean, like, is that how you feel in your live shows as well?
I felt less like that during the live show because you can always feel how the audience is reacting to you. And so you can always kind of gauge the energy of the audience. And especially like in an improv show, you're not really trying to be like the focal point. You just kind of do what is organic in the scene. Mm-hmm. And you know what, like where the scene takes you, like whatever the energy of the scene, like you just like make a choice and then whatever the audience responds, however the audience responds to that is where you go with your choice. So if in the start of an improv scene, I eat an apple in a funny way. And that was like kind of the first big pop. Then I feel really confident because that's just the energy of the scene. And, I have the safety of the magic of the improv. But if we are on a film set, I was very nervous. I'm like, oh man, like, I don't know. What am I supposed to, like, who am I? You know, it sounds like one of those talking head points in every documentary. You got to understand, the year was 2019. There was no Bo and Yang.
I don't know. It's just interesting to hear you say that, you know, because I mean, this is probably totally confirmation bias, like after the fact kind of thing. Because, and also, you know, I've known you for like 10 years. We used to work in the film room, the film equipment room at York together and just talk about basketball. And so I'm a fan, right? And I watched the show. I'm like, how come he's like a supporting character? You know, I mean, this is just my own opinion, my own, like, you know, just my own questions. And so it's interesting to see, you know, or to hear you talk about it like that, you know. And do you feel like it's a less collective experience shooting the show versus your live performances?
No, I think like the four of us, it's still like we all, like someone might pitch a sketch, but everyone kind of, it's almost like a exquisite corpse. Everyone has like a pass on everything generally, mm-hmm. unless it's a like very personal monologue. It's incredibly collaborative still. And even when we're on set, we'll pitch each other jokes. Like, yes, season two with Bruce McCullough directing, it was way more, we were way more comfortable because it was a familiar relationship and we knew he would incorporate any idea that we had and he was very protective of our voice. Yeah, so it was like really, it was still very collaborative. I think the difference was like us feeling way more confident on a set versus mm-hmm. like a Toronto Sketchfest show. You know, when we were entering the Toronto Sketch Comedy Festival, our bio was a diverse group of comedians doing diverse things diversely. and I think like that's how we described our comedy. But then there is always like the awareness of what is the audience thinking and how can we subvert that? And then like, there's also like the whole, like our own internal journeys where we are like trying to find confidence and find permission to, you know, to make mistakes as well and find forgiveness in ourselves if we do make those mistakes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And do you feel like that's something that you are kind of, I don't know if burden is the right word, but that you carry more than another type of group might?
Like, I can't say for anyone groups or anything, but I feel like personally, maybe a little bit more just because I like comedy, a lot of the times it's this joy of like, it's at nighttime and everyone's smoking and getting drunk and like, let's just have fun, bro. Let's just make funny sounds and see what happens, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think it's like Pete Holmes was saying like comedy is like a lot of the times what the kids are saying when the teacher is not around. But you get to a certain age where you think, my gosh, am I the teacher? And what, mm-hmm. you know, and then it's like, well, am I doing teacher comedy right now? I want to be part of the, I want to be a student. So it's like you want to have fun. You want to be irresponsible. It's just like, you want to like make it feel truthful to you. But sometimes like, there are a lot of like, obstacles in the way that, might affect the writing. Like, you want it to sound very clear and be very funny in this particular way, but you just don't, you know. I think at a certain point with the writing, you just kind of have to let go and trust that, like, the comedy will be perceived by who you want it to be perceived by.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds like you do feel a pressure or burden to be more circumspect, like, you know, just with everything that you do, right? Like every little piece that's part of how you know that you are a diverse group of diverse friends doing things diversely, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think we definitely want to have fun and take risks and just go out and say, yeah, we don't give a fuck, but I want you to have a good time too.
Yeah.
And so I think it's just like, yeah, the difference I found with like stand up and filmmaking is like in filmmaking, like if you copy a particular aesthetic, if you're like doing Quentin Tarantino, he's like just like taking whatever movies he liked and just stealing it and making a movie, and it's like perceived as like, oh my gosh, this, he loves cinema, he's a real cinephile, this mm-hmm. is a true auteur. But like in stand-up, I can't be stealing Seinfeld's joke and be like, you guys ever notice and then also in as a comedian, like when you first are doing comedy, like you definitely are stealing from comedians, even if you're not writing their jokes. You're like definitely like imitating your favorite comedian's cadence or like delivery style, even if you're not conscious of it. And it takes like a little bit of time to find the confidence and bravery to try and write in your own voice. And I think like as a stand-up, I'm still like trying to figure it out. Yeah, I think that's the thing is like with stand-up. And, you know, yeah, it's just like with a lot of my comedy writing, it's like early on, I was writing a lot of like, well, what will make the audience laugh? And in my mind, the audience was like, you know, Toronto Yuck Yucks crowd, you know, this Hamilton crowd, you know, whatever show in Guelph, like the back room, the 2 a.m. crowd of like the Groove Bar, like an audience that maybe might not necessarily look like me or like, feel like how like I was trying to be funny, but what was funny to me, like I was trying to match this objective idea of what funny was. And then like as I met these other guys, and I just kind of, as I'm becoming more comfortable with my voice and becoming more confident with my abilities, I'm able to be a little bit more honest with my writing and be funny and be more comedic in the way that I feel is truthful to me. Tall Boys premieres Tuesday, 9:30.
But yeah, I think that's what comes out for me is like the possibility. Like there's, I think, not just like what you share today about your own like personal growth, but like I think like the existence of Tall Boys is just like this possibility. And I was watching this show with my mom, and we have such different, like, we laugh at such different things, but I had never seen her laugh that hard before. So I just want you to know that my mom is a fan.
Sweet.
Yeah. You are definitely reaching other audiences, and wanted to share that I also see there's like a lot of room for like imagination and like the possibility of things of other conversations happening. Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. Oh man, who's your mom? Well, the thing, like one of the sketches I'm quite proud of is like we just like this, I think they just uploaded it today as a promo for the next episode, which is there's a children's, I think it was originally titled Children's Book Revealed, but it's like is interesting, like the construction of that sketch, because like at first it comes from like a meme that I saw that revealed the stats that like it was like something like 80% of all children's books are white characters, and then the other like 12% are like animals, and then 8% BIPOC children, right? And it's just like I was like, what is this? So Like there's like a bunch of ways you can go about writing or conveying your point of view, your take on this stat in a comedic way. You can just write it as like, oh, here's, this is stupid and this is dumb. But I think we needed to find like a comedic game where, yeah, I mean, it was like really exciting to find like a comedic game where like it's not preachy. And I think that's what we're always trying. Like, we don't want to just like tell people how to feel all the time, but just like convey things in a, like a playful way. And that was just like a lot of fun because it's like, yeah, I mean, when you hear something like, the sketch, the books, I guess it's because we're so familiar with them, but like they, like in theory, it shouldn't really be so ridiculous that these books exist, but it's just because we're so accustomed to like books that are dominated by whiteness that this feels weird. But like when, if it were so common. And then also there's a joke in there that I wish stayed in there, but didn't make it because of time. Like right after you see Consent Dracula, my character goes, just because you're invited in doesn't mean you can do whatever you want, Ty.
That sketch is amazing. Yeah, that I was dying and I watched it several times. It's so funny. And it is, it has that layer, or it has so many layers to it, you know? Because it is, you know, turning things around. And even, you know, I also noticed too that there's a lot of, there's great performance by the three of you in there too, you know? Yeah. I just loved everything about that one. That's by far my favorite.
Oh, thanks. So Aaron, Kelly's mom, you're next, the rest of Canada.
Yeah, it's really nice to hear you really intentionally mention like centering joy is such a huge part of the process. And I guess on that, just like thinking about like what would be some advice that maybe you would now give yourself from, I guess, I'm not sure when you started, but I guess maybe let's go back to.
What would you tell Franco in the York film equipment?
I think the best advice is just to start creating, because it feels like there was a lot of nights where I was like bombing at a show, and like on really, really bad shows, going up at like 1:30 in the morning at like, you know, taking the blue night from Coxwell to home, and just like wondering, like, man, what am I doing with my life? But I think I just wish, just to go back, like, just I really wish I was just present with it and enjoyed each show as it was. And because like when we met each other, and when we formed our sketch group troupe together, it felt like really magical. It felt like we really had a great chemistry. And when we did our first sketch, the PSA sketch that you see where with all the slurs in it, that was like our first sketch we ever wrote together. And it like did so well at this small open mic, but the feeling was so, it was really magical. And it felt so great to get that feeling. And then like that, we just kept working together, and then we put sketches that we really enjoyed that really made us laugh. And we put a set together that got us a lot of attention at the Toronto Sketch Festival. So I guess the advice would be just to like, no matter what level you're at, make the work that speaks honestly to you, and then it also makes you laugh and that you truly find funny. Because you can really, spin your wheels and like really like over edit something that like maybe just doesn't stick to you. And with comedy, like the great thing about like stand up and sketch, it's like there's so much volume. Like you're just trying to write what clicks with an audience, what gets a laugh. So you're just like it's almost like, you're just like constantly writing and you're throwing things away all the time. Whereas I think like before I got really serious with comedy, I was like super precious with a lot of things. but I feel like I write mm-hmm. a lot faster now, and I'm always willing to throw something away. Yeah. Marie Kondo School of Comedy. If it doesn't spark joy, throw it away.
No, I'm just like, hold on to everything. I'm like, cannot really. But I mean,
So just to wrap it up, like, you know, we're looking forward to season two. It's coming out. People can see it on CBC Gem. Are there other projects you're working on, and anything else you or anything you want to plug, SoundCloud page or something like that?
Oh man, a SoundCloud page. I wish I was, that's my other dream, to be a rapper. No, I'm trying to adapt my one person show, Good Morning Vietnam, formerly Saurian Liquid Skies. I'm trying to like figure out a way to put that on wax, on screen. So I'm just trying to work on that right now. Yeah. And then, yeah, we're just like watching the show, but the main thing is to check out Tall Boy season 2 on CBC Gem.
Well, thanks. Thanks, Franco.
Yeah.
Thank you. And whoever's listening, I hope you learned something today. I hope you've been inspired.
Backstory Podcast is presented by the Toronto Real Asian International Film Festival. It's written and hosted by Kelly Loy and Aram Collier, and is edited and produced by Sungwoo Beck. You can find Franco on Instagram and Twitter at Franco Wins. And you can watch the second season of Tall Boys for free on CBC Gem. For more information about the show, our festival, or upcoming events, find us on Instagram and Twitter at Real Asian. If you have any questions or comments, write to us at backstory@realasian.com.